We're going to speak about Yom HaTzmaut. Is it a holiday? Is it not a holiday? There are in the religious community many different perspectives on the day. There are those that consider it a yontif, in the respect like Chanukah and Purim, and they say Hallel, some with a bracha, and some people sit on Yom HaTzmaut on the floor and say Eicha and Kinos, and some people are ambivalent to the day. They don't consider it a yontif, they don't say Hallel, they say Tachnun, regular day. In regards to halacha, on the other hand, they look upon it, some in a very positive way and some in a very negative way. Any historical occurrence, how we view it, and what perspective we view it from, and whether we celebrate it, commemorate it, and in what way, for a Torah Jew, has to be based on halacha, as everything else is, and on a perspective of Torah, which is basically determined by Gedolei Yisrael, like everything else in Yiddishkeit. It's no different. We don't determine how we view things and how we relate to them and if and how we commemorate them by our gut feelings and our emotions. And how the Torah and those people who are the ones responsible to pass the Torah on to us and explain the Torah in every generation. Gedolei Yisrael, Vayaminu Bashem uVeMoshe Avdo. The Torah can only exist if we accept the fact that it's Gedolei Yisrael that pass on that Torah and explain it to us from generation to generation. Without that, there is no Torah. How people who view things from a Torah perspective view them, and how we view them are many, many times very, very different. I'll give you an example. We're not going to go into the details of this, just for an example. There are 2 days in the year that Chazal said we should commemorate. One we commemorate as a fast day, and the other we commemorate as a yontif. What happened on these days? The first one is Tes Teves. On Ches Teves. On Ches Teves, a miracle happened. Talmi HaMelech, the Egyptian king, wanted the Torah translated into Greek. First art scroll translation of the Torah. And he got together 72 of the Talmidei Chachamim of the generation, put them in separate cubicles, and they all translated the Torah the exact same way. And the changes they had to make in order not to make a Chilul Hashem, all of them, the Ruach HaKodesh, made the exact same changes. There shouldn't be a Chilul Hashem. The Talmud should say, you see, they didn't say the same thing. Miracles. Mamish miracles. And now the Torah was available to the nations of the world. Torah Shebichzad. The other day, on Tisha B'Av, about 50 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the last stronghold of Bar Kokhba was destroyed on Tisha B'Av in Beitar. and hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed, and their bodies were left unburied for 3 years. 3 years later, on Tu B'Av, two miracles happened. They were able to bury the bodies, and the bodies hadn't decomposed. Now, if you'd ask me how to commemorate these 2 days, I would have made a Yom Tov on the first one and a fast day on the second one, because the people didn't come back to life. They just were able to be buried. So it minimized the Avelis a little bit, but it brought it back up. Here are hundreds of thousands of people are being buried. How did the Chachamim relate to it? They made a fast day on the day the Torah was translated into Greek, and they said it was as difficult as the day that the Luchos were broken. And they made a Yom Tov, Shelo Hayu Yomim Tovim Kechamishasar B'Av Kiyom HaKippurim on Tu B'Av. Mamash, the opposite of what I, with my eyes of flesh and blood, and my brain with gray matter, would have decided. But the Torah has a different perspective, and the Talmidei Chachamim, who represent the Torah, have a different perspective. Not only that, every historical occurrence has many perspectives, and they're true, even though they seem to be contradictory. The same occurrence can at the same time be a happy occasion and a sad occasion. We have it in Tanakh, in Sefer Ezra. When they built the second Beis Hamikdash, it says there were an equal amount of people crying and people rejoicing. Who was rejoicing? The people who never saw the first Beis Hamikdash, who were born in Golus. So they were rejoicing. Here's the Beis Hamikdash. But the people who were born already during the first Beis Hamikdash, old people, people who were over 70, their 80s, 90s, who had seen the first Beis Hamikdash in their teens, and now saw the second Beis Hamikdash, were crying bitterly. Because the second Beis Hamikdash was missing some incidental things that happened to exist in the first Beis Hamikdash, like the Shechina, like the Aron, like the Luchos, like the Urim V'Tumim, the Eish Min HaShamayim. All those things existed in the first Beis Hamikdash. They didn't exist in the second. So they were crying. This is a poor excuse for a Beis Hamikdash. And they're both true. Two perspectives. There was the half a glass of water that was full and the half that was empty. And whether to commemorate an occasion or not is also not so simple. We are mourning for 33 days Talmidei Rabbi Akiva, who died right all during this period. These were Talmidei. Do you know that there were times that the entire generation of Gedolim, the entire Sanhedrin, was wiped out, was killed. In the time of Hordas HaMelech, in the time of Yanai HaMelech, they killed all the Chachamim of their time. Do you know when it happened? You have 1 day of mourning? No. And those are the Rabbonim, not the Talmidim. For Talmidim Rabbi Akiva, we mourn for 33 days. And for the entire Sanhedrin, we don't mourn at all. Again, I'm not explaining the reason why now. But obviously, some things we do commemorate. Some things, the Rabbanan said, we don't commemorate. How about, what's it called? The day that we conquered Eretz Israel and settled it. There was a time. It took 7 years to conquer Eretz Israel. It took 7 years to split it up. Sometime during that time by Yoshua, there should have been a day, which was Yom HaAtzmaut, the day that we got our independence and we conquered Eretz Israel. There's no such thing. Never was. How about the second Beis Hamikdash? Ezra came back, built the second Beis Hamikdash. There should be a day, or there should have been a day, that they celebrated every year the day they built the second Beis Hamikdash, that it was finished. It was a certain day. We don't even know when it was. Never such a day. Not the first Beis Hamikdash either. So the fact that great occurrences happened, But they're not commemorated. They're not, there's no such thing, not from the Torah, not from the Rabbanan, of days to commemorate these things. I understand why. But all I'm trying to show you is nothing is so simple that just because something that happened that is momentous, important, or whatever, has a commemoration, or becomes and turns into a yontif. Not a yontif to Rabbanan, not a yontif to Reis. Purim and Hanukkah. There was Nevi'im still in the time of Purim. It took years before the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were convinced that they should establish Purim. Didn't happen right away. Didn't happen right away. And how they should establish it went through metamorphosis, Chazal said. Originally they did it like this, and then they decided like this. It wasn't so simple. And then we're Nevi'im. In the time of Hanukkah, there was still a Sanhedrin. And it wasn't so simple to establish Hanukkah. It took a year of discussion before they decided, yes, to establish Hanukkah and how to establish it. What to do, what not to do. So it's no wonder that now we don't have any Nevi'im, and we don't have a Sanhedrin, and there's tremendous differences of opinion of how and if to commemorate Yom HaTzmaut, the day that the State of Israel was established. And the truth is that it is a very emotional topic, both in Chutz La'aretz and here in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, it's emotional, I think, because it's very much tied up with people's death. A lot of people here in this country, almost every family, has somebody who was killed in some war. And in establishing the state. And therefore it's a highly emotional issue that somebody who doesn't celebrate this day is like ignoring the sacrifice that these people made. And on the other side there's also a lot of emotion. The state was established basically by a group of secular Zionists who came here to Eretz Israel and stole away the authority that existed here from the Frum community, what we call the Yishuv HaYashan. They were here. They were here way before the secular Zionists came. They were here in the middle of the 1800s already. The Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. I'm sure you've learned this in history. The Zionists didn't come till the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s. And they made a concerted effort to undermine the Kehillah that was here, the Yishuv that was here, and to make educational institutions that tried to pull their children not only away from them, but away from Torah, and to create a secular society here, which they're still trying to do. So there was a war, not much a cultural war, a religious war, Melchemes Mitzvah, against that. And the people who are here for generations, don't forget it. And it's the whole idea of how the state became a state and who was behind it and what their intentions were isn't forgotten by them. We came on the scene, you know, us Americans or whatever, and we just see a state. We don't understand what the underpinnings of the state, what brought it about, what was the culture war that went on. So we're not, we don't have those kind of feelings. But the people who have been here for generations do have those feelings. So on both sides, tremendous emotional. In America, I think there's another reason why it's very emotional. You know, there's a difference in halacha, whether you say a bracha on Hallel on Rosh Chodesh or not. It's machlokas. The Vilna Gaon says you don't say a bracha on Hallel, that's how he paskins, on Rosh Chodesh, if you daven by yourself, only b'tzibur. And we all, you say a bracha. I never saw people get into a fist fight because one said they say Hallel with a bracha on Rosh Chodesh and one says you don't. Never. This one says I follow this posek and this one says I follow this posek. When I was a rabbi in Miami, so in my shul, as I will try to explain in the time that we have, why, but we didn't change the davening on Yom HaTzmaut. We said Tachnun, we didn't say Hallel. That was the regular shul minyan. However, I had a Bnei Akiva chapter in my shul, and they asked to be able to have a separate minyan where they would say Hallel without a bracha. With a bracha, I didn't permit them. At this time, I'll explain to you why, but without a bracha. And not to say Tachlin. And I permitted them to have that minyan, and things, Baruch Hashem, went very nicely. Those who wanted to daven with the minyan, with the akiva, daven there. People wanted to daven a regular davening, daven in the shul. And this went on for quite a few years. Till one Yom HaTzmaut, I overslept. And I came to shul late. And instead of finding two minyanim davening, I found something going on in the courtyard of the shul. Everybody was surrounding something and cheering on something that was going on in the middle of the circle. So I pushed my way into the circle and found two very respectable doctors beating each other up. Mamish. Fist fight. Everybody else had decided this was much more exciting than davening. So they were standing around with their talus and tefillin and cheering on their favorite boxer. What happened? The minyan, the Bnei Akiva minyan, since it was mostly made up of teenagers who have hard time getting up in the morning, didn't have a minyan at 7:30 when davening was supposed to start. There was a large minyan in the shul, was made up mostly of older people who have trouble sleeping. So they were all there. So one of the doctors, who was an ardent religious Zionist, who davened in the Bnei Akiva minyan, went to the regular minyan and asked a few of the older men if they would come and help to make the minyan until the other people came, they could go back to the regular minyan. Another doctor, who was an ardent anti-Zionist, who was in the regular minyan, went over to this doctor. They two didn't like each other anyway. And he went over to him and he said, not only are you an apikoros and a rasha who davens in your Bnei Akiva minyan on Yom HaTzmaut and say Hallel, but you're also a mesis of Mediach. You're taking these poor, innocent old men who have no interest in davening in your minyan and pulling them away to your minyan. So they started yelling at each other, and from the yelling they started beating each other up, and the whole shul decided that this is much more interesting than davening. I never saw that happen about Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Never. Why is it so emotional? So what I think is the following. Anybody who lives in Chutz Laretz and Sfrum has to have some guilt feelings inside of why they're not living in Eretz Yisrael. The Maisa, if our ancestors could have lived in Eretz Yisrael like we have the opportunity today, I don't think anybody would have stayed anywhere else. They would have run to the opportunity. And I'm not saying that everybody has to live in Eretz Yisrael. There are legitimate reasons why a person does not have to live here. But it's a shaila in halacha, whether those reasons apply to you or not. Most people don't even consider it. They just assume that it's okay to live where they live and finished. So there has to be some guilt feelings of not being in Eretz Yisrael when we have such an easy opportunity to go and live in Eretz Yisrael. So some people erase those guilt feelings by becoming gung-ho Zionists. And they say, well, if I sing Hatikva every time I go to eat, and I sing Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut with eight brachas, then that's the same thing as living in Eretz Yisrael. Right, I support the state and everything, and I dress blue and white every day, and that's as good as living in Eretz Yisrael. So that becomes very emotional, because when you're dealing with guilt complexes, things become very emotional. Or some people go the opposite way. And they say, right, this is all subconscious, not conscious. Right, I can cover up my guilt about not living in Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael today has been taken over by the Zionists. And it's not Eretz Yisrael, it's Medinas Yisrael. And who would want to live in that treif of Medina? So I'm potter from living in Eretz Yisrael because of the Zionist government that's there. So whenever you're dealing with guilt feelings, you're dealing with tremendous emotions. So the people of the super Zionists and the people of the super anti-Zionists, a lot of times, is to cover up their guilt feelings of living in Chutz Laretz. And therefore it's a very emotional issue. Now, it should be clear that whether one supports the state of Israel or does not support the state of Israel, has nothing to do with whether he holds of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or loves Eretz Yisrael or not. Eretz Yisrael and Medinas Yisrael are not synonymous. Not in any way. Not from religious people, not from irreligious people. There are many people who love Eretz Yisrael and despise Medinas Yisrael. Don't accept it, don't recognize it. There are people who have lived here for generations, 7, 8 generations, Yerushalmis, who wouldn't ever think of leaving Yerushalayim, let alone going to Chutz Laaretz. They haven't left Yerushalayim their entire lives. They love the land, but they don't recognize the state of Israel. Some of them despise the concept of the state of Israel, but they love Eretz Yisrael. And there are many people who are tremendous patriots to the state of Israel, I'm not talking about religious Jews, who have nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael. They like the Jewish state, and it didn't make a difference to them, we'll see historically, whether the Jewish state was in Israel or in Uganda. The main thing is that there should be a nationalistic Jewish homeland, and that's the ikker. And Eretz Yisrael is not an ikker. They couldn't care less about Eretz Yisrael. No love for the land, they have love for the state. And the state could exist anywhere, according to them. So, the two are not synonymous. And it's pretty much clear that if you are a Torah Jew, then you revere one, or most of us, both, of Gedolei Yisrael, who existed within the last 300 years, and clearly held that there's a mitzvah to settle Eretz Yisrael, even in modern times, even when there is no Beis HaMikdash. Those two Gedolim were the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. Both of them themselves wanted to come and settle in Eretz Yisrael and were prevented to do so by circumstances beyond their control, min hashamayim. And they both sent their Talmidim to settle here in Eretz Yisrael. And this was in the middle of the beginning and middle of the 1800s. So the Talmidei HaGro settled here in Yerushalayim, in Hebron, the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov in Sfas, in Tveria, and they held that settling Eretz Yisrael in modern times a mitzvah. Not only that, that it's something that will help to bring Mashiach, being the kind of mitzvah hakluyos baaretz. So they set up colonies and they set up farms and agricultural settlements in order to fulfill the mitzvahs of Kluyos Baaretz. There was even movements in Europe prior to the secular Zionists, before Zionism ever started, Chovevei Tzion, that were mostly run by frum people. Not everybody agreed with these things. They wanted to establish not a homeland, they wanted to establish settlements in Eretz Yisrael, and bring Jews to Eretz Yisrael, again, to Mekayim Mitzvos HaKluyos Baaretz, and to settle the land. And these were organized groups, run mostly by Rabbanim. There were people who were not from or also involved in them. There were Gedolim who were very much in favor of these movements. There were Gedolim who were against them. The Netziv from Balashin was very much for. Reb Shamshon Falhirsch was one of the ones who was against. And the Hungarian Gedolim, Chassidish Gedolim, mostly were against Munkacher, whatever. So there were positive, negative. We'll see why, what the idea was, why there was an opposition, why there were people who were for or against in a few seconds. But Lamaisa, whether someone loves Eretz Yisrael or not, is not synonymous with whether they are pro or con the state of Israel or Yom HaTzma'ut. It has nothing to do one with the other. Nothing to do. There are people who celebrate Yom HaTzma'ut who have no regard for Eretz Yisrael. The people who love Eretz Yisrael don't celebrate Yom HaTzma'ut. So what is the question? Question is that the state of Israel is not and was not formed because of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, or any mitzvah. It was the outgrowth of a secular nationalistic movement that in its essence was not necessarily, not religious at all, and to a certain degree anti-religious, which we'll get to in a second. Secular Zionism was created by Theodor Herzl in the end of the 1800s. Theodor Herzl himself was a assimilated Jew whose parents were also assimilated. So he knew little about Yiddishkeit, very little. And therefore you can't really blame him too much for being irreligious and being, in the beginning at least, ambivalent to religion. But it bothered him very much that Jews suffered. He was very much upset about anti-Semitism. And he wanted to find a solution to anti-Semitism. I always say, Eina Kodesh Baruch Mekapeach Schar Kol Beria. I'm sure that he'll get rewarded for that. Somebody who has feelings, it bothers him, the Jews suffer. I'm sure that that the Rabbeinu Shlomo does not ignore that. On the other hand, his solutions were horrendous. I guarantee you he will not, well, I can't guarantee anything, it's not my job. But I don't think that he's going to get rewarded for his solutions. Especially his first solution. When he was a younger man, he decided that the solution to anti-Semitism is mass conversion to Catholicism. It makes sense. If there's no Semites, you can't have anti-Semites. So if all Jews become Christians, this problem will be solved. And he wrote in his diary that the proudest day he can imagine is the day that all the Jews of his city will march together with the Catholic priest to the Catholic church and be baptized. However, after the Dreyfus trial, Dreyfus was an assimilated Jew, not religious at all, not doing religion, totally assimilated. And he was the brunt of a anti-Semitic libel. He was an officer in the French army, and it caused terrible anti-Semitism all over Europe, especially in France. And he realized then that religion has nothing to do with it. Because here's a guy who's not religious at all. He's not identified as a religious Jew, right, as an observant, believing Jew. And yet he's also the brunt of anti-Semitism. So he decided that's not going to cure anti-Semitism. He came up with a new idea. And that is the reason that the Goyim hate us is because we're different. We're abnormal. We live in their lands. We speak their language. We make use of their services. And therefore, we're not normal. But if we would have our own land and speak our own language and have our own post office and our own army and subsequent Zionist thinkers, Achad Ha'am, one of them, said, and our own perverts, and our own criminals. No, really, he really said it. So we'll be exactly like the nations of the world. Normal. Like they are. Then we will, what's it called, they'll accept us like they accept each other. I don't know what he was thinking, because they don't accept each other too much either. But at least we wouldn't be different. Right? They hate us like they hate each other. But they wouldn't hate us special. And therefore, his dream was to create a Jewish state, a Jewish country, where we would be normal like everybody else. Now, in the beginning, he was not concerned what the character of this state would be. Religious, not religious, Torah, no Torah, he didn't know too much about it, and it didn't bother him, one way or the other. However, the Russian Zionists, the Russian Maskilim, saw this as an opportunity to further their agenda. The Russian Maskilim had already been very, very active for the last 50 years, probably, maybe even almost 100 years, from the time of the start of the Reform and the Haskalah, of trying to transform the Jewish people into a enlightened people, enlightened men to throw off the yoke of the Torah. And the Reformers and the Maskilim looked for every chance to fight the establishment, which was basically Rabbanim, and from people. Most of the kehilas in Europe were run by the rabbanim and run by from people. And they, in every way that they could, tried to wrest the authority in every kehila away from the rabbanim, away from Torah, and to make their agenda, to transform the Jewish people. And they weren't successful in many places because from Yiddishkeit had been entrenched there for hundreds of years. And now they wanted to change it. It wasn't so easy. They saw this as an opportunity. If there's going to be a state, a national homeland created in Eretz Yisrael, and they're going to build it from the beginning, if they jump on the bandwagon, they'll be able to form and shape that state the way they want it to be. And they'll have a place where this enlightened Jew will be able to sprout. And they'll get rid of the yoke of the Torah. So they joined forces with Herzl. And they had a lot of influence on him and made him, to a certain degree, anti-religious too. And he wrote after that they'll build a Beis HaMikdash in this new place, new country, as a museum to what Judaism used to be like. And they'll have secular marriage, and they will lock the rabbis in their synagogues, make sure they don't get involved in the politics of the country or whatever, and the country will basically be a secular country, and with a museum to remember what Judaism used to be. But it will be a normal country like everybody else. In any case, Herzl, at that time, Palestine or Eretz Yisrael was in the hands of the Turks. And Herzl thought that he could go and bribe the Turkish government to sell land in Eretz Yisrael and to give the Jews a place where they could create this homeland. And the Turks took the money, but they didn't do anything. And he was very, very unsuccessful. And they, again, started the Zionist movement. They had a World Zionist Congress. This was like at the end of the last few years of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. And when they got together, in the beginning, there were many from Jews as part of the Zionist movement. Rabbanim, even Hasheva Rabbanim. Because originally, it basically was a movement to settle Eretz Yisrael. There was opposition even then, at this point, because there were Rabbanim who held that settling Eretz Yisrael en masse, making a political entity in Eretz Yisrael before Mashiach comes, is also. That was one opinion. Because the Gemara says that when we went into Galus, one of the things that God made us promise, it's not actual, but it means one of the things that the Torah decreed upon us, is that we would not take Eretz Yisrael by force. And therefore, going back, and also Shelo Yalu B'choma, that's what it said. We won't go back to Eretz Yisrael en masse and take it by force. We'll wait in Galus until the Ribbono Shel Olam takes us out of Galus. But to leave Galus en masse and take Eretz Yisrael by force is awesome. So they held that any movement that tries in a national way to resettle Eretz Yisrael is awesome. Other Gedolim held no. That's only if you take it by physical force. But if you can convince the nations of the world to let us go back, then we're allowed. Could be the whole Jewish people as a people can't pick themselves out of Galus. But individuals most certainly can go and set up a Jewish autonomy in Eretz Yisrael as long as it's done with the permission of the nations of the world. We don't have to fight them to get it. That was a difference of opinion. Amongst those who held the first way, you're familiar with the Satmar Rebbe, but he came on the scene much, much later. But originally the Munkacher Rebbe, there were others who held like that, and a name that you can relate to, the Or Sameach, Meshech Chachmah, Meir Simcha Dvinsk, held the other way. That if, as long as we have permission of the nations of the world, no problem. In any case, right within the first few years of the formation of the Zionist movement, there was a big debate that went on within the movement itself, what exactly their purpose was. Many saw the purpose merely as securing a place in Eretz Israel for Jews to be able to live and to be autonomous. That was it. What kind of autonomy, what kind of a kehila, what kind of community will it be? What will be the description of that community? That wasn't their business. They left to others. There was a group, like I said, especially the Russian Maskilim, who had another agenda. They wanted to make sure that when this autonomous community will be created in Eretz Israel, it'll be the way they want it to be. Maskilim. No Torah, secular, whatever. And therefore, they said, the Zionist movement has to be involved not only in securing settlement in Eretz Israel, but also with culture and with religion. Culture and education. Culture and education, to make sure there won't be any religion. Culture meant something to substitute for religion, and the education to make sure that the next generation is educated with that culture. And that's part of the Zionist movement. Obviously, the Fum people who were involved in the Zionist movement were against that. That's not your business, culture and education. That's the business of Rabbonim. It's not the business of secular people to decide what the character of the Jewish people is going to be in Eretz Israel. And there were tremendous debates and fights. This was in the beginning of the 1900s, and about 1911, when this debate was still going on, one of the Choshev Rabbonim of the time wrote the following. He said, if the Zionist movement is going to continue to press that their place is to determine culture and education also, and to make Eretz Israel something that's a substitute for Torah, then we rabbis are going to have to take Eretz Israel off the agenda completely and totally disregard it. Even though it's a mitzvah and it's important, but there's a precedent to that. The precedent was the Aseres HaDibros. They used to say the Aseres HaDibros every single day in davening together with Kriya Shema. And when the early Christians began to say that there's nothing in the Torah that is binding except the Aseres HaDibros, and the rest of the Torah is not binding anymore because of Yashka, the rabbis took the Aseres HaDibros out of davening because it's confusing. Because what are people going to say? Well, you see, the Christians are right, because we give it special importance to the Ten Commandments too. We also put it in davening. So they downplayed it, and it's awesome to put the Aseres HaDibros into davening again. You can't say it as part of davening anymore. So he said the same thing over here. If these secularists are going to claim that Eretz Israel is a substitute for Torah, then if we rabbis make a big deal about Eretz Israel, which it deserves, it's going to be confusing. So we're going to have to put Eretz Israel on a back burner and de-emphasize it. Who do you think that Adam Godel was? Don't tell me the Sofmer Rebbe, because he's probably in short pants at the time. This, we're talking 1911. Right? Maybe the Munkacher Rebbe, maybe Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. It was Rav Kook who said that. All I wanted to do is to point out to you that no one held that Zionism, which purported to want to change the character of the Jewish people and make Judaism depending on nationalism, held that it was anything but Avodah Zarah. No one. Not Rav Kook, not Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. That was, no one held differently. The question only became later how to deal with the Zionist movement. But that Zionism, where nationalism takes the place of religion, where being a country, a nationalistic country, and being a patriarch of the country takes the place of being a from Jew, that's apikorsis. No one disagrees with that. No one. The question became very, very lamaisa when the Zionist movement voted whether their agenda should be without culture and education or with culture and education. This was after 1911. And the vote was that they should deal with culture and education, meaning Zionism means creating a state, a homeland in Eretz Yisrael that's secular, period. And that takes basically the place of the Torah, where nationalism, patriotism, takes the place of Torah. As Achad Ha'am wrote, he said that somebody who is a patriot to the Jewish state is considered a good Jew. And even if he's a Christian, or married to a Christian, and somebody who's a frum Jew, who's not a patriot, is not a good Jew. The definition, who is a Jew? The whole question today in the state of Israel, who's a Jew? What determines what makes a Jew? Is it halacha, Torah, or patriotism to a state? You're a good citizen of the state, you could be a Jew. Even if you're not Jewish, halachically, you're called a Jew. That shaila is at the very foundation of Zionism. Zionism is a philosophy that substitutes patriotism and nationalism for Torah. And that's how Bikurs is, according to everybody. When the Zionist movement voted that this is going to be their agenda, most of the frum people who were part of it left. And they started another organization. That organization was called the Mizrahi. The religious Zionists. They felt they couldn't no longer be part of the Zionist movement directly, because the Zionist movement has put on its flag the abolition of Torah. So they split off and they formed what's called Mizrahi, and that was one organization that started around this time, the 1911, 1912, something like that. Around the same time, another organization started. That was called the Aguda, Agudas Yisrael. Both organizations had the Rabbanim behind them, but the majority of Gedolei Yisrael, recognized Gedolei Yisrael, were pretty much behind the Aguda. The Chafetz Chaim, the Ger Rebbe, were prime movers, Reb Chaim Osher Grozinski. These are the people who were recognized as the Gedolim of the time. They were the ones who predominantly were the prime movers of the Aguda. The difference between the Mizrahi and the Aguda was, this is very condensed, there's much more to go into, but let's just get the Iker parts over here so we see that we finish. The major differences between these two groups were the following. The Mizrahi held, based on the das of certain Rabbonim, and we're not talking about Rav Kook yet. Rav Kook originally was part of the Aguda. We're talking about Rabbonim that came way before that, who held that a way to bring Mashiach is by creating an autonomous homeland in Eretz Yisrael before Mashiach comes. That's a necessary stage in bringing Mashiach. They had this idea that Mashiach comes miraculously only after we prepare the way naturally. So first there's going to be the Tkufa Mashiach ben Yosef, which is basically the beginning of the Geula, Atchaut of the Geula, Reishis Smichas Geulaseinu, which will happen naturally, where we will redeem ourselves politically, and then the Rebbeinu Shel Olam redeem us spiritually. Not like it happened in Mitzrayim, where both things were done miraculously. But for some reason, they had a sheet, and there's a lot of Sfarim written about it, whatever. I heard from Rav Moshe Feinstein directly, heard it from him, not secondhand. I was sitting where you're sitting, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was sitting where I'm sitting, or standing where I was, and that's how far away I was. And he said that this concept of Reish Yismichas Gulaseinu, Aschalta de Geula, that a Geula can start when there's political autonomy, and that's the beginning of Geula, is not true. It's a toast. It's a mistake. There's no such thing. Doesn't it just? That's what he held. It's a mistake. And even though you'll find Midrashim that say that the Geula comes slowly, like the dawn, just like the dawn comes slowly, that doesn't mean that before Mashiach comes, there's going to be a Geula that will culminate with Mashiach. But if you look at the Rambam, it's the opposite. The Geula will start when Mashiach comes. But it won't culminate, it could be for hundreds of years. And there could be a time when we're not sure if Mashiach is really Mashiach. They'll claim to be Mashiach. They'll have to prove he's Mashiach. In order to prove you're Mashiach, you have to do basically two things. If you do those two things, then you're for sure Mashiach as long as you have the credentials. What is those two things? Build the Beis HaMikdash and bring all Jews into Eretz Yisrael. Anybody who does that, who has the credentials, is Mashiach. So far nobody's done that. Nobody. And the Rambam says that if somebody claims to be Mashiach, and he's a tzaddik, fine person, whatever, and he doesn't build the Beis HaMikdash, and he doesn't bring all of Klal Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael, and he dies, then you know for sure he's not Mashiach. The Rambam doesn't say that we wait for him to come back the second time. That's Christianity. Right? So that's, that in itself is a side point. In any case, so somebody, what's it called, the Geula starts when somebody claims to be Mashiach who has the right credentials. It doesn't culminate till he'll build the Beis HaMikdash, bring all Jews into Eretz Israel, and then be Mashpi on the whole world to be Makabel the Rabban Hashem. That could take hundreds of years, the Rambam says. It's a slow process. Could be. Could be. It'll happen quickly. But it could be a slow process. But it doesn't culminate with Mashiach. It starts with Mashiach. In any case. So that's one difference. The Aguda held from those Gedolim, who were a majority of Gedolei Yisrael, that this concept of Reishis Michas Gulaseinu Aschalt doesn't exist. There's no such thing as Geula being redeeming yourself politically. And that is, there was a difference of opinion. Some said that doing that is Aser. And some said doing that is not Aser, it's not necessary. If it'll help, fine. Won't help, it's not a good thing. But if you can do it politically, there's no Iser in creating a Jewish autonomy in Eretz Yisrael before Mashiach comes. There was those held as Aser. The Mizrahi held it's important, it'll bring Mashiach, you have to do it. That's the beginning of Geula, that's how Geula works. Three different opinions. Second difference, the Mizrahi, because they held that securing a place in Eretz Israel before Mashiach is going to bring the Geula. This is the first stages of Geula. They held that was the primary agenda of Klal Yisrael, to do that, to see that that's done. Everything else was secondary. The Aguda, since they held that that was not an Iker, they held the primary agenda of Klal Yisrael at the time was strengthening the yeshivas in Europe, because without the yeshivas, Klal Yisrael can't exist. We've existed for 2,000 years without Eretz Yisrael. We can't exist a day without Torah. And the yeshivas were on the brink of destruction because of poverty. They were going to try to make the situation in Europe as good as could be at the time. That was their major thing. And they also said, we'll work to secure settlement in Eretz Yisrael, because that's also a way of solving the problem in Europe. Better get out of Europe. But that's not the major agenda. The Mizrahi, that was the major agenda. The third difference was also an Ikra. The Rabbanim of the Mizrahi held that even though they couldn't be part and parcel of the Zionist movement because it's apikorsis, but since they were working on the same for the same goals, they also wanted to settle in Eretz Israel. So did the Zionists, they could work together with the Zionists. And the Gedolim of the Aguda held that if it's talking about working with people who aren't from, you can work with people who aren't from. But you can't work with an organization who's apikorsis. It's like saying, look, I want to build a building, you want to build a building. You want a church, I want a shul. So we'll work on the common ground, the walls. And then we'll fight it out if it's a church or a shul. That's absurd. We don't have any common ground. You want a church, I want a shul. If you're working with an organization that in its essence is apikorsis, you can't work together with them. So the Aguda held they have to work on their own. They can't work even under the umbrella of the Zionist movement. And the religious Zionists held they could work under the umbrella of the secular Zionist movement, even though the secular Zionists wanted Eretz Israel for a reason that they held also was apikorsis. But the Lamaisa will work on the common things and will fight on the other things. That was the differences, the basic differences. Now until World War I, nothing changed. Herzl died. The beginning of the 1900s, didn't see any success. He died of a broken heart. Basically, he saw that the dream of building a state or whatever was pretty much impractical, impossible. The Turks weren't interested, and nothing ever came of his efforts. He died. During World War I, things changed drastically. Because for various political reasons, England... In World War One, are those who have finished saying Dylan? For various political reasons, the British government, who probably, if they were on the side, the winning side of World War One, would get the mandate for Palestine, and they wanted Jewish help in the war effort. So they made a declaration, they made a deal with the Zionist movement, that if they gave the help that they were looking for, then they would, when they got the mandate on Palestine, they would be favorably inclined to give the Jews a homeland in Eretz Israel. In 1917, Lord Balfour made his famous Balfour Declaration that the His Majesty's government looks favorably on the establishment of a homeland for the Jews in Eretz Israel. That declaration was very wishy-washy. Didn't say that it was going to be a state. Didn't say what kind of homeland. It said clearly that's only if it's not going to hurt the rights of other peoples there, meaning the Arabs. And Gedolei Yisrael received this in two ways. They say the Chafetz Chaim cried when he heard the Balfour Declaration. And he said, this is what we waited 2,000 years for. For some goy to say that they look favorably on letting us go back to Eretz Yisrael, and this is what everybody is rejoicing, and this is it, this is the Geula. See, this is what the culmination of Jewish history is. Some goy telling us that he thinks favorably about us going back to Eretz Yisrael. That's what people are rejoicing. And Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, they say, was extremely happy when he heard it. And they asked him, "What's the big deal? I mean, what the Chafetz Chaim said is right." So he said, if it hadn't rained for 2,000 years, and for 2,000 years there hadn't been a cloud in the sky, and one morning you woke up and there's a little puffy cloud, first cloud in 2,000 years, wouldn't you be happy? Hasn't rained yet, but the mice or something's changed. 2,000 years, nobody's been talking about letting Klal Yisrael go back to Eretz Yisrael. All of a sudden, the world's talking about is going back to Eretz Yisrael. It's something to be happy about. In any case, so after the Balfour Declaration, the Zionists were very, very happy, right? That now they have a really practical chance of getting their dream. But the British very quickly realized they made a big mistake, because the Arab reaction was disastrous. And they realized they need the Arabs a lot more than they need the Jews. And there's a lot more of them, and they also had oil. So they did everything in their power to basically make that Balfour Declaration inoperative and bugged, totally negated. And then there was a white paper, there was a study made, and they came out with, but basically the conclusions of the white paper were to stop all or most immigration to Eretz Yisrael by Jews, not to upset the status quo. They favored the Arabs, they made it very hard for Jews to live in Eretz Yisrael, to the point where there were groups that were set up to fight the British underground in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. This went on till World War II. Basically, until World War II, the Balfour Declaration was basically bottle, and it didn't look like there ever was going to be a state. World War II changed that, unfortunately, not in a good way, because of something terrible, because Jews were murdered, and the Jews that weren't murdered had no place to go. They couldn't go back home to Poland, Ukraine, wherever they... Russia, because they were murdered. They came back. Goyim had taken over their homes, and most of them were killed on the spot when they came back, because the Goyim weren't interested in giving them back their homes, and they were worse anti-Semites than the anti-Semites and the Nazis were. No free country, including America, would take in, except more than a token amount of Jews. They all had quotas. And Jews who were fleeing the concentration camps during World War II and right before World War II went around the world looking for some haven, and no place would take them in, and they ended up being sent back to Europe. Famous the St. Louis and the boats that were sent back. And after the Holocaust, the survivors had nowhere to go. And if they tried to go to Eretz Yisrael, the British didn't let them land in Eretz Yisrael and put them into DP camps in Cyprus. They were afraid that they would upset the Arabs if they let too many Jews come into Eretz Yisrael and upset the demographics. So they didn't let, and they killed Jews who tried to come into Eretz Yisrael. They had border patrols or whatever. And a lot of Jews were smuggled into Eretz Yisrael during that time. So in any case, everybody realized at that point that this was a matter of pikuach nefesh. Because the Jews, these Jews' lives, the survivors were in danger, there was no place to go. And therefore, the United Nations made a commission to decide what to do with Palestine. And they came up with a partition plan, that part of it would be given to the Jews, where they could proclaim their state, and part to the Arabs. The map was not the map of Eretz Yisrael today, not even the pre-67 map. It was a little bit of Tel Aviv, a little bit of Yerushalayim, a little bit of Haifa, and most of it was Arab, to the point where everybody was hoping that if both sides would accept it, what would happen within a few days, the Arabs would overrun us, and that would be the end of the problem. It was made in such a way that the Jewish enclaves were surrounded by Arabs all over. Baruch Hashem, the Arabs didn't accept it. They didn't want it. They wanted everything. And they said that if the state is proclaimed, they will proclaim a war. And they'll throw us into the sea and destroy every man, woman, and child. That was their threat. They don't want a state. They don't want an Arab state. Right? Two states. They didn't want it. They wanted everything. And we had to go before this commission to decide if the Jews wanted. And the Aguda, even though they weren't necessarily for a state, because they didn't hold it was such an inyan dafke to have a state, but they realized that it was pikuach nefesh. So they made up with the secular Zionists, we will go before the PO Commission, the United Nations Commission, and say we also want a state. As long as in that state, there'll be a status quo of religion, nothing less than it was when the Jews were there. Same religious things will be. Shabbos and Kashrus or whatever. If you'll make us promise that you're not going to make this a totally secular country, but there'll be no less than the religion was Yiddishkeit in the time of the British, we will go before the Peel Commission and say we want to stay too. And nobody said differently, because if they would have, the guy would have said, well, if the Jews don't want it, why should we give them a state? Not all of them want either. So united, the entire Jewish world went before the commission and said we want it. And because of that, an ace happened. And the United Nations voted to partition Palestine in November 1947. And that was an ace. Mamash an ace. Was the only United Nations vote till the end of the Cold War that the United States and Russia voted the same way. I don't know which one was a bigger nace. Because the people who were in the State Department in the United States were terrible anti-Semites. And Roosevelt also was an anti-Semite. Now we know. Then we didn't know. And he was on the, behind the scenes supporting the Arabs. Baruch Hashem, he died before this vote took place. And Harry Truman became president, and he happened to be favorable to Yidden. So the Rabbanu Shlomo makes things work out very nicely. In any case, so in November 1947, the United Nations voted that Palestine should be partitioned, which means the Jews had the right to declare a state when the English would leave. The English were scheduled to leave on May 15, 1948. Which happened to be Vav Iyar, which happened to be a Shabbos. And they had debates whether they should declare a state or not, because if they declared a state, the Arabs said they'd throw us in the sea. If they didn't declare a state, then they couldn't open the borders, and the Jews who were survivors of the Holocaust had no place to go. So in the end, Ben-Gurion decided, with his cabinet, they were going to declare the state. But he knew that if he declared it on Shabbos, it would not be practically good, nor a positive thing to do. So he preempted the declaration of the state to the Friday before, which was Hei Iyar, which is Yom HaTzmaut. And on that day, Mamish, as soon as he declared the state, that night, the Arabs attacked. And the War of Independence began. It didn't end on Hei Iyar, it began on Hei Iyar. So, you can understand hashkafically, the Mizrahi, when the state was declared, saw it as the beginning of Geula. It's a Yontif. Now, whether you can make a Yontif, how you make a Yontif, that's a different story that I don't have time to do now, maybe some later time, or maybe with the regular class that I have, I'll speak about it next week. But you can see, hashkafically, they held it's a Yontif. It's the beginning of Geula. The Aguda, on the one hand, the Aguda split over the issue of the state. There were some Gedolim, most Gedolim, most of the Litvische Gedolim, the Hasidische Gedolim, held that once there's a state, even though it's not necessary, but it had a purpose, and there are positive things definitely that would come from it, the state, even though it was run by the secular Zionists, basically, but it was a democracy. So the state itself is part of it. The state is not apikorsis. The state is a part of the entity which is run by people. And whichever people are in control, that's the kind of state it'll be. So if you don't get involved in the politics of the state and take the advantage of the democratic process, then you're giving it into the hands of the apikorsim to make it a place of apikorsim. So it's a mitzvah to vote, and it's a mitzvah to be involved, and the people in the Aguda were involved in the government in the beginning. They were part of the government. And they signed on the Declaration of Independence. Because they held that which the Gedolim of the previous generation said, you can't deal with an organization that's apikorsis, doesn't apply to a state. The state is not apikorsis. The state is an entity to itself. The people who run it may be apikorsis, but the way to fight them is by getting involved in the political process. Another group, smaller group, held that the state is just the manifestation of secular Zionism, and just like you couldn't have anything to do with secular Zionism, you can't have anything to do with the state. And you can't accept the state that's called Israel that's not run up Torah. That's basically run by Apikorsim, not run Alpi Chukei HaTorah, run on secular law. It's a Chilul Hashem. And therefore you can't recognize that such a state is a state of Israel. And there are people who therefore live here, don't recognize the state. They pay whatever they have to pay taxes so they don't get thrown in jail, but they don't benefit from the state, they don't support the state. That's the Naturei Karta. The Eida Haredis, the Briskers are pretty much like that. Most Gedolim held not like that. The Chazon Ish, amongst them, the Panovich Rav, Rabbi Reuven Grozovsky, who was the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah at the time, Rav Shach, you were familiar with, or whatever, all held the Stipler, that's a mitzvah to vote in elections, to be involved in the politics, as a way of fighting the secularists to see to it that the state is at least as according to halacha could be. Those are the three deists. You can understand the people who saw the state as a chilul Hashem, and not only that, they held that taking over Eretz Yisrael by force, even political force, is asur. Not only that, they held that it was physical force, because we had to fight the Arabs to get it. The other Gedolim held no. The nations of the world who were in charge gave us it. They voted. The Arabs attacked us. We had a right to defend ourselves. We didn't take it from the Arabs by force. We got it for permission of the nations of the world. We had to defend it, then you can defend yourself. And they held no. The Satmar Rebbe held that since the people who were here didn't give it to us, and they fought us, so we took it by force. And that's awesome. So not only isn't it the beginning of Geula, it pushes away Mashiach. And it's Chilul Hashem. So they look at the day that the state was declared as a day of mourning. The Mizrahi looks at it as a day of rejoicing. It's the beginning of Geula. And the Agud is somewhere in between. It's not the Geula, right? And there's a lot of negative. It's true. It is a state that represents Klal Yisrael, and it's not Al-Pi Torah, which is a Chilul Hashem. On the other hand, having a state has a lot of positive, practical, we're here. You wouldn't be here if it was under Jordan, I guarantee, neither would I. So I'm able to live here, and Yidden are able to live. Torah is able to grow here, because there's a state, which wouldn't be if there wouldn't be a political autonomy. And again, the state is not synonymous with secular Zionism, or with Apikorsis. It's a state. It's a part of the thing. It's a clique. So you can understand now why, at least hashkafically, there are three different approaches to how to look at the state of Israel. Halachically, what you do on the day, how to commemorate it, if to commemorate it, or whatever, is a different story. You don't commemorate things and make halachas based on your hashkafas, based on, there has to be halachic basis. That's a different discussion. Amir Tzashem, if next week you can convince Rabbi Sharfman to let you come back again, we'll talk about the halachic ramifications.